Imagine you are the mayor of a small coastal town. A terrible storm is coming. You want to close the beaches, order evacuations, and direct emergency funds to shelters. But who actually has the power to make these decisions? Can you act alone? Do you need permission from the regional government? Does the national government have the final say? The answer to these questions depends entirely on what kind of government system your country uses. And that question of who holds power and where that power sits is one of the most important questions in all of political life. Today we are going to explore two very different answers to that question. One answer is the unitary system, where power is concentrated at the top, in a central national government. The other answer is the federal system, where power is deliberately divided and shared between the national government and smaller regional governments, like states or provinces. Both systems have worked well in different countries and in different times. Both have also produced serious problems. Understanding the difference between them will help you make sense of why governments in different countries behave so differently, even when they face the same challenges. Let us begin with a story that makes the difference very clear. It is early 2020. A dangerous new virus is spreading around the world. Two neighboring countries, let us call them Country A and Country B, must respond. In Country A, the national government in the capital city makes a decision on a Monday morning. By Tuesday, schools across the entire country are closed. By Wednesday, every citizen, whether they live in the busy capital or a quiet fishing village 300 kilometers away, is under the same rules. Wear a mask. Stay at home unless necessary. The message is simple and identical everywhere. In Country B, things look very different. The national government in the capital issues advice and warnings, but the actual decisions about closures and restrictions belong to the leaders of each state or province. The governor of one state, looking at crowded hospitals, orders everyone to stay home immediately. The governor of a neighboring state, worried more about the economy, keeps restaurants and beaches open. In one large city, the mayor requires masks in all public places. In the county just outside that city, no such rule exists. Citizens in Country B are living just a few kilometers apart, but under completely different rules. Country A is using a unitary system. Country B is using a federal system. Neither response was perfectly right or perfectly wrong. Each reflected deep choices about how power should be organized and who should hold it. Let us look at each system carefully. A unitary system is a way of organizing a government where the central government holds all the ultimate power. Think of it like a large company with a head office. The head office makes all the important decisions. Regional offices exist and they do real work, but they are created by the head office. They follow the head office's instructions, and the head office could close them or change their responsibilities at any time. The head office is in charge. That is the basic idea of a unitary state. In a unitary state, the national government is what political scientists call sovereign. Sovereignty simply means having the final, supreme authority. If you are sovereign, no one above you can overrule your decisions. In a unitary state, sovereignty belongs to the central government. Local governments, regional councils, and city authorities do exist, and they handle many local matters, but they exist because the central government allows them to exist. Their powers are borrowed powers, not owned powers. France is one of the clearest examples of a unitary state. France is divided into areas called departments, which function a little like counties or provinces. But these departments do not have independent constitutional authority. The national government in Paris sets the rules for education, justice, national security, and much more. A local leader in a small town in southern France cannot simply decide to run the local schools in a completely different way from a town in the north. The national framework applies everywhere. Japan works similarly. Japan has 47 prefectures, which are its regional divisions. They handle some local administration and have some flexibility in local matters. But the national parliament, called the Diet, holds the supreme legislative power. Legislative power simply means the power to make laws. The Diet sits at the top of the system. Now, The United Kingdom is an interesting case because it is a unitary state that has shared some of its power in recent decades, but without giving that power away permanently. The UK Parliament in Westminster is sovereign. It is the final authority. However, starting in the late 1990s, Parliament chose to transfer, or devolve, certain powers to a Scottish Parliament, a Welsh body called the Senedd, and a Northern Ireland Assembly. Devolution means giving powers downward to a lower level of government. Scotland can now make decisions about its own education and health systems, for example. This sounds a little like federalism, but there is a crucial difference. Parliament gave those powers voluntarily, and Parliament could, in theory, take them back. The power was lent, not constitutionally guaranteed. In a true federal system, which we will discuss shortly, the regional government's powers cannot simply be taken away by the central government because they are protected by the constitution itself. So, what are the advantages of a unitary system? Think back to the storm example at the beginning. If you need fast, decisive, coordinated action, a unitary system can deliver it. There is one decision maker. There is one chain of command. Everyone follows the same rules. This can be enormously valuable in a crisis. It also creates equality between citizens. A child growing up in a poor rural area gets the same national standard of education as a child in a wealthy city because the national government sets those standards for everyone. Citizens also know clearly who to hold responsible when things go wrong. If schools are failing, you know to look at the national government. Accountability, meaning the ability to clearly identify who is responsible for decisions, is simpler, but unitary systems have real weaknesses too. Imagine trying to run a country as large and diverse as China from one central point. China is in fact a unitary state, though a deeply complex one. A rice farmer in a tropical southern province and a nomadic herder in the cold northwestern plateau have very different needs and lives. A rule that makes perfect sense for one may be absurd for the other. This is the problem of the one-size-fits-all approach. When all decisions flow from the center, local knowledge and local needs can get ignored. A distant government may not understand or respond well to the specific realities of faraway places. And when enormous power is concentrated in one place, there is always the risk that it could be abused. Concentrated power can become unresponsive power or even authoritarian power, meaning power used to control and suppress rather than serve the people. Now let us turn to the federal system, which takes a completely different view of how power should be arranged. A federal system is one where power is divided between the national government and regional governments, and this division is written into the constitution itself. A constitution is the fundamental written document that sets the rules for how a government operates. It is the highest law of the land. In a federal system, the constitution is like a contract that says here are the powers that belong to the national government and here are the powers that belong to the states or provinces. Neither side can simply take the other's powers away, because both are protected by the constitution. This is a profoundly different idea from the unitary system. In a unitary state, the central government is the source of all power and it shares some downward. In a federal state, the constitution is the source of power and it distributes it in two directions simultaneously, to the national government and to the regional governments. The United States is the oldest and most studied example of a federal system. The founders of the United States were deeply suspicious of concentrated power. They had just fought a revolution against a distant king who they felt ignored local needs and ruled without true consent. When they wrote their new constitution in 1787, they deliberately created a system that would make it very difficult for any one institution to hold too much power. The constitution listed specific powers given to the national or federal government, things like maintaining an army, making treaties with foreign countries, and printing money. Everything else, all the powers not specifically given to the national government, were reserved for the states. This idea was written explicitly into the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. An amendment is an addition or change made to a legal document, in this case a change made after the original Constitution was written. The 10th Amendment says simply that powers not given to the federal government belong to the states or to the people. This is why in America, education policy is primarily a state responsibility. This is why criminal law varies from state to state. This is why the legal age for drinking alcohol can differ between states. Each state is, in a real constitutional sense, its own governing unit with its own sphere of authority. Germany offers a different and fascinating model of federalism, sometimes called cooperative federalism. Germany is divided into 16 states called Länder. In Germany's system, the national government, called the Bund, tends to make the broad national laws and policies. But it is actually the state governments that are primarily responsible for carrying out and administering those laws. The two levels are deeply intertwined and expected to cooperate. Germany also has a very clever structural feature that reflects this cooperation. Its parliament has two chambers or houses. The lower house, the Bundestag, is elected directly by the German people. But the upper house, the Bundesrat, is made up of representatives sent directly from the state governments. This means state governments have a direct, formal voice in making national law. They are not just passive receivers of decisions made at the top. They actively participate in shaping those decisions. India gives us yet another variation.
India's system is described by many scholars as quasi-federal, meaning it has federal characteristics but with a significantly stronger central government than you see in the United States. India has constitutionally recognized states, and the constitution divides powers between them and the central government. But the central government has some remarkable powers that a truly federal system would not normally allow. For example, in a genuine national emergency, the central government can essentially take over the administration of any state. The central government also has the power to redraw state boundaries, which the American federal government cannot do unilaterally. India's system reflects a particular historical anxiety about national unity, given the enormous diversity of languages, religions, and cultures within the country and the experience of partition and conflict during independence.
So, why would any country choose to divide its power this way, rather than keeping it unified?
The reasons are compelling and they go to the heart of political philosophy. The study of what government is for and how it should be organized.
The first reason is the protection of liberty. When power is divided, it becomes much harder for any single person or group to seize control of everything.
If a dangerous political leader took control of the national government in a federal state, the state governments would still have their own powers, their own laws, their own institutions.
They could resist. They could serve as a counterweight. This was exactly what the American founders were thinking about.
James Madison, one of the chief architects of the American Constitution, wrote that in a federal system, the state and national governments would check each other, each preventing the other from becoming too powerful. A check, in this political sense, means a limitation or a control on someone else's power.
Think of it like the brakes on a bicycle. The brakes do not stop you from riding, but they prevent you from going so fast that you crash.
The second reason is what the American Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis famously described as laboratories of democracy.
He used this phrase to capture an important idea. In a federal system, 50 states or 16 Länder or however many regional units exist can each try different solutions to the same problems. Some experiments will fail, but some will succeed brilliantly, and the successful ones can then be adopted by other states or by the national government itself. The policy spreads because it has been tested and proven to work at a smaller scale.
This has actually happened many times in American history. Women were given the right to vote in several Western states, including Wyoming and Colorado, decades before the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote nationally in 1920. Gay marriage was legally recognized in Massachusetts in 2003, and after more states followed, the Supreme Court eventually recognized it as a national right in 2015.
Environmental regulations that first appeared in California later influenced federal law.
These examples show how one state acting as a laboratory gave the whole country a chance to observe, learn, and eventually adopt the policy on a larger scale.
The third reason for federalism is responsiveness.
A government that is close to the people it serves is more likely to understand their needs and respond to them effectively. A state government in Louisiana understands the culture, economy, and geography of Louisiana far better than a distant national government possibly could. Local and regional governments can make decisions that fit local realities. They can move faster because they are dealing with smaller, more defined problems. But just as unitary systems have weaknesses, federal systems come with serious problems of their own. Let us be honest about them. The first problem is coordination. When many different governments all have pieces of the decision-making power, agreeing on a common response to a shared problem becomes very difficult. The COVID pandemic example at the beginning of our lesson illustrated this perfectly.
In a country where each state decides its own rules, people can be confused, angry, and endangered by the inconsistency. Viruses do not respect state boundaries. Neither do river floods, financial crises, or terrorist threats. A fragmented response to a national emergency can cost lives. The second problem is inequality. When states have control over services like education and healthcare, the quality of those services depends heavily on how wealthy each state is. A rich state can spend much more per student in its schools than a poor state can. This means the accident of where you are born determines how good your education will be. In a unitary state, the national government can redistribute resources, taking taxes from wealthier areas and using them to provide equal services everywhere.
Federal systems can try to do this too, but the logic of separated powers makes it harder and more politically contentious.
Contentious means likely to cause disagreement and argument. The third problem is blurry accountability. Remember how we said accountability is clearer in unitary systems. The opposite is true in federal ones.
When something goes wrong, it can be genuinely difficult to know whether to blame the state government or the national government.
When a bridge collapses, was it the state's responsibility to maintain it? Was it the national government's responsibility to fund it?
Politicians in both levels of government often point fingers at each other, and ordinary citizens can be left confused and frustrated, unable to hold anyone clearly responsible. There is also a deep ongoing debate about what happens to federal systems over time. Many political scientists have observed that even in countries designed to be federal, power tends to drift upward toward the national government over decades. In the United States, this drift has been remarkable. The national government has used its financial power, its control over funding for roads, schools, and healthcare, to pressure states into following national standards. This is sometimes called coercive federalism, because the national government is using money as a kind of lever to make states do what Washington wants, even in areas that the Constitution designates as state responsibilities.
Coercive means using force or pressure to make someone do something. The states are not legally forced to comply, but if they refuse the federal funding, they lose enormous resources their citizens depend on. It is a powerful form of indirect pressure. Germany actually designed its system partly to address this kind of drift.
By making state governments direct participants in the national legislative process through the Bundesrat, Germany ensured that states have a real voice in how national laws are written.
They do not just receive orders from above. They help write those orders in the first place.
Now let us think about some of the larger questions these two systems raise, because the choice between them is not just technical. It reflects deep values about what government is for.
Consider the question of minority protection. This is a phrase that refers to protecting the rights of groups of people who are outnumbered, whether by religion, language, ethnicity, or other characteristics. Federalism can be a powerful tool for this.
If a particular ethnic or linguistic group is concentrated in one region of a country, giving that region significant political autonomy, meaning the power to govern itself, can allow that group to protect and express its culture in ways a distant central government might not. Canada's province of Quebec, which is predominantly French-speaking, has used its provincial powers to protect the French language and culture even while the rest of Canada operates primarily in English. Switzerland's federal system allows its German-speaking, French-speaking, Italian-speaking, and Romansh-speaking communities each to have significant self-governments. But federalism can also be used to harm minorities. In the American South, for nearly a century after the Civil War, state governments used their autonomy to maintain laws that systematically oppressed Black Americans. Segregation, meaning the forced separation of people by race, disenfranchisement, meaning the deliberate removal of people's right to vote, and widespread racial violence were all protected and enabled by state-level political power. It was ultimately the national government, acting through federal courts and federal legislation in the 1960s, that finally dismantled those systems of oppression. In that historical case, the central government was the protector of minority rights, and state autonomy was the weapon being used against them. This historical reality is crucial to remember. There is nothing automatically good or bad about either system. Everything depends on who holds power and how they use it. There is also the question of how globalization, meaning the increasing connection of countries through trade, communication, and shared problems, challenges both systems. Climate change does not stop at national borders, let alone state borders. International trade agreements made between countries affect the lives of citizens in every state and province. Global pandemics spread across every level of government simultaneously. Both unitary and federal states are discovering that some of the most important problems they face cannot be solved by any single level of government acting alone. They require cooperation not just between national and regional governments within a country, but between countries themselves. This is a new layer of complexity that neither the founders of American federalism nor the architects of French centralism had to worry about. There is no perfect answer to the question of which system is better. The research is honest about this. Scholars genuinely disagree. The right system for any given country depends on its history, its size, its cultural diversity, the threats it faces, and what its citizens value most. A very small, culturally homogeneous country, meaning one where most people share similar backgrounds and values, may function beautifully as a unitary state. A vast, diverse country with multiple languages, religions, and regional identities might need federalism to hold itself together while still respecting local differences. What we can say with confidence is this. Every system of government faces the same fundamental challenge. How do you give government enough power to do its job, protecting citizens, providing services, maintaining order, without giving it so much power that it becomes a threat to the very people it is supposed to serve? The unitary system answers this challenge by concentrating power and relying on good institutions and democratic accountability to keep it honest. The federal system answers it by dividing power and relying on competition and mutual checking between levels of government to keep any one of them from becoming too dominant. Neither answer is complete. Both contain wisdom and both contain risk. The best governments in history, regardless of which system they used, have been ones where citizens remained engaged, informed, and willing to hold their leaders accountable, whether those leaders sat in the national capital or the regional one. Let us now gather together the key ideas from today's lesson. A unitary system is one where the central government holds supreme power. Regional governments exist and function, but their powers come from the central government and can be taken back by it. France, Japan, and the United Kingdom are examples. Unitary systems tend to offer clarity, speed of decision-making, uniformity of laws, and clear accountability. Their risks include being unresponsive to local needs, potentially over-centralizing power, and applying rigid solutions to diverse situations. A federal system is one where power is divided between the national government and regional governments by a written constitution. Neither level can simply abolish the other's authority. The United States, Germany, India, and Canada are examples. Federal systems tend to offer protection against tyranny, space for policy experimentation at the state level, and greater responsiveness to local needs. Their risks include coordination problems during crises, inequality between regions, blurred accountability, and the slow drift of power toward the center over time. The key difference is where sovereignty, the final supreme authority, sits. In unitary systems, it sits at the center. In federal systems, it is constitutionally divided. Historical examples like the American Civil Rights Movement remind us that neither system automatically protects vulnerable groups. The value of either system depends entirely on how its power is used. And the modern challenge of global problems like climate change and pandemics is forcing both types of systems to reconsider how much any single level of government can really handle on its own. Most importantly, the choice between these systems is not just a technical or administrative one. It is a reflection of what a society believes about liberty, unity, diversity, and the purpose of government itself.